an unusual posture for an introduction to be sitting, but it works. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce the two readers tonight. My name is Mark Pavlak. I'm a poet and an editor. I edit Hanging Loose magazine in Brooklyn, New York. The first reader tonight, Steve Luttrell, sort of is in the same kind of tradition, poet and editor. He's been editing Cafe Review for 25 or 26 years. Plumline is his newest book. I think he's his fifth or sixth full collection, plus numerous chapbooks as well. So I was just thinking, my co-editor Dick Lurie, who's sitting right here, so between Steve and Dick and myself, we cumulatively add up to 110 years of small press literary editing.
No wonder I'm so tired.
That's why you're so tired. So Dick's been doing it 50 years. I've been doing it 35, and Steve's been doing it 25. So there you go. So it's a very fine tradition, and Steve has really been putting out this terrific magazine for all those years. Is a really fine poet himself. We've sort of circled around. Louisa Solano, who used to manage the Grolier bookstore, always told me, "You have to meet Steve Luttrell." And I said, "Okay, when's he gonna come down from Portland?" And somehow we never actually connected until about 3 months ago when Steve read in Somerville. So I got to hear him read for the first time from this new collection, Plumline. And I think the thing I was most struck by is the musicality of his verse and the kind of musicality in his delivery. Not spoken word, but poems that work on the page, but which are really, really read with a rhythmic punctuation that I found was really effective. And so without further ado, I want to introduce Steve Luttrell.
Polis. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this evening's adventure. And it's an adventure for me because about, 25 years or so ago, I had a group of poets come down to Portland. They read for me at the Café No, and they all became dear friends. And one of them was the late Walter Butts of New Hampshire, and the other one was the late Vincent Farini of Gloucester. And Vincent said to me on that evening, "I'll try to do a good Vincent. You've got to come down to Gloucester and read." So Vincent, here I am. It took 25 years, but better late than never. As Mark alluded to, I do have a new title out, but before I read from that, I would like to take the opportunity to read a small bouquet, three of them, for Vincent. As I'm here, it seems like the only thing to do is to begin with a few poems that I read, that I made for Vincent. The first one's called The Fog Master. Make no mistake, directions in a fog are useless gestures of good faith, as tides afford no comfort coming and going as they do and have done so long at this shore. Second poem, Farini Lost His Shades. Under the dog star black enveloped sky, July begins to melt our purpose. The breathless edge of summer quakes and grumbles, fructifying silent in the heat. And you have come from Gloucester with poems in your teeth, and dancing down the waterfront you sing, "Where are the women? Where are the women dancing tonight?" he answered his own question shortly after. The reason I used the word fructifying was consciously because I remember on that evening's occasion of asking him, we talked about vocabulary, and I think we were talking about Jack Spicer. Anyway, it came up that fructifying was one of his favorite words. So this is the last in my bouquet of poems for Vincent. It was simply called For You. For you, I would the marvelous weave a charm of sound, would sing the dream that gathers the distance of our years. For you, the poem waits. For you, the poem waits and lingers for a while on the lips. So, Vincent, those are for you, brother. So, now we'll move on to more current. Henry mentioned that in October, one of my actual friends, and I'm really glad that Michael McClure is coming here because he's been a little frail lately. So I'm glad to hear that hopefully he will come. This is, in fact, a poem I wrote for him because he was very helpful to me in my life at one point. If I can find it, I will find it. It's here somewhere. The Marcus Mount Washington Quartet. Quartet. Air, water, light, everything is right, is all we need, and we are part of all this great creation. We are part of this hunger under sun. Everything is this. Sky blue and tangerine and rose streaks through gray clouds, all elements of early summer sunset. Beautiful as any living face, and brief as any mayfly in the light. It's all expanding with a new electric language. Bits and bytes, a whole new measure made to make us take us forward. Science turned to art, gold as information. Hail the new alchemy. What are we to make of it? This given thing, this ancient, new, and changing thing that rolls in space and seemingly will roll and roll forever, or maybe not. We are moving towards some of the poems in Plumline, albeit slowly. One of the things that I'm sure you've all experienced, because most of you, if not all of you, are writers. I guess it's true, we only do read to each other, right? And when you come out with a collection of poetry, in this particular case, it's been 10 years in the making, so a lot of the poems that I read from the new book are, in fact, old poems. So it's nice to be able to read from manuscript, too, I guess. My own particular poem, if you will, is Portland, Maine, and that's the only place that I know where I can walk around the whole thing in 2 days, and that's what my poem is about, Portland. So I did write some poems around that fact, and if I can find them conveniently, I will read them, and if not, I will move on to something else, but... It's always, I suppose everyone has their own approach to giving readings, and I just kind of like to discover the poems that I wrote from a long time back, and they're like old friends to me, actually. But in the meantime, we'll read something from the new book. One of the things that I'm vexed with is machinery in terms of technology or anything that doesn't, eat, drink, and metabolize and has moving parts. Sometimes they vex me, you know. So this poem is called Landscape with Machines. Machines are our companions where we're going. Machines are our companions, all stainless, in their steely skin, cold and so conclusive in their sadness. They know us by our touch. And no surprise, they read our eyes with laser-like precision. Already we are not alone. Machines are our companions in an age of information. All clockwork, inconspicuous. Machines are our companions in a landscape like no other. Machines become our witness. As we are going, machines become our witness. And from us, they'll take the measure and continue, and machines will keep our history. After all, functions fail, and there is memory in the junk. And they to us will be as we to them. This is kind of a, I found it to be a funny story. I don't know. I have a very close friend that comes from and lives in, is back living in Kansas. We knew each other many years ago in California, and we are both from away, and we both moved back to where we came from. And so Ray moved back to Kansas, and I sent him my book, and he's a wonderfully innocent man for having served two tours in Vietnam. He came back in a very childlike way, in my opinion, in a good way. Anyway, I sent him the book, and he loved this poem, and he sent me a letter, and he said, "Steve, I really liked that poem. In fact, I liked it so much, I enhanced it." And I'm reading it tomorrow night at the local open poetry affair here in Lawrence. And he sent me a copy of the enhanced version of my own poem written out, which I thought was marvelous. And this poem is called K, and I wrote it because I'm a big fan of Kafka, and I won't need to go beyond that. He thought it stood for Kansas. And so he wrote this entire new poem using my poem as a nucleus. And a friend of mine said, "Aren't you pissed off?" I said, "No, it's wonderful. It's now has a life of its own off page 5. Anyway, this is the poem K that I wrote. Can't be responsible for one that Ray wrote. In this story, no one gets redeemed or comes to any true conclusions. The days become impossible with worry. The enemy is never seen, always a menacing presence. No simple answers asked or given. Everyone stands accused. At some point in the future, a knock comes at the door." I think Ray liked that because basically he's paranoid, and I think that he you know, it resonated with him. This is called Dogs. "I make for them a special place in heart's accommodation, those friends who came when called and stayed as long as time allowed, and in whose company, whose constant company, a tenderness was found." This is a poem I wrote for my mother, who Phyllis Luttrell, 1911-1999. "Gone with all those words of well-wishing, still gone. The doctor's tone of resignation stuck like a burr in my memory. The air thick, a heavy weight of vacancy suspended, your hands in a sad gesture, one upon the other. The skin pale and paper thin, the hard activity of each breath, eyes closed to eventual fade. You had said that time was going backward. You were my mother and I loved you, now gone beneath the soil with a prayer." These do become old friends. And the other thing that I hope some of you or many of you may have experienced is The satisfaction of making a poem for a friend, it's, you know, a little gift. And we were talking about Dr. Williams a little earlier. They're little, you know, little word machines that you can make for your friends, because that's what you do, I mean, make poems. This is a poem I wrote for a gentleman who lived down the coast from me, Ted Enslin. It's called Nothing Left for Ted. Beginning with it all laid out against improbable conclusions, one gets caught up in it, moved along, and suddenly old age becomes attendant. The energy runs out. One marks time, takes notice, missing not so much, and full having nothing left. Dear friend, made great canes too. Made carved canes and ironwood until he couldn't find any more ironwood. Sort of like Vincent couldn't find any more driftwood, so he stopped making the frames. I guess when you run out of things. I don't know. I'm going to read a few, I think, now, because I can. You know, I'm not keeping an eye on the time. You better give me the... Somebody needs to...
You're doing fine.
Am I? Good. Because, you know, I'm just... Time is not something that I... Rilke's Dark Music. What was it you heard in that dark music, that terrible silence hung heavy like a stone cloud over your solitary travels? And how in wonder did you find the questions, asking what form angels take outside the frame of time, or how from Blake or Swedenborg you differed? And what were the markers of those seasons no calendar records? What would you have of angels and their labor to reconcile the people with their God? And looking for a hero, come to realize there are no heroes now. No womb brings forth that fruit today. Sadly, 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 sadly. Doubt. We're quickening the pace here. Doubt. It was always about beginnings. The first push to what seemed most insistent. The impulse then to act, to bring off some occasion of my own doing. Because I was alone, quite alone. My thoughts became the company I kept. But something intervenes, moves between the thoughts, a questioning, uneasy in its movement. And he is strong who would take unto himself such doubt. I am not that man, and if this is that or that, it matters in some crazy way. It's not for me to say. I won't. I can't. I am not that man. I guess one has to come up against their shortcomings. I have a dear friend, Hafid, back in Portland. And Hafid is from Casablanca, and if you ever come to Portland, I hope you meet Hafid Lalouie. He took the picture for my new book. Amazing photographer. So he keeps saying to me, because we're 19 days apart in our ages, but he's older. I wrote this poem for Hafid. It's called Growing Old. Growing old is not so hard. It takes no effort, no special knowledge. It comes without thought, steady in its measure. I have come to it by increment and not determination, to arrive at a place while still arriving is a continuum of consciousness, an awareness of the temporal in things. There is nothing that I am that does not wonder at the process. Growing old is not so hard. It's what we do until we don't. You've been born, and that's the first and last ticket. I'll try to lighten things up, not try to sound so... What's the word tonight? Apocalyptic. So I think I'm externalizing my apocalyptic visions. comes from reading too much Weldon Keyes and John Barrowman. Those people can drive you to jump off bridges. The movies. Things can happen at the movies when you're going on 16. Hands grow sweaty, holding on to dreams, to possibilities. Fumbling to reach and take your hand by instinct or the chemistry of gland. I can't remember now what the movie was or who the starring role. Only that my hand was sweaty and the movie ended and you moved away all those years ago. Are we doing on time? We're still rolling? Okay, good. All right. I like to write literally. I do type them out. I do type them out, but McClure talks about, among others, the physicality of writing. And so for me, the physical is actually writing it, and then I will type it out. But these are in manuscript form, very 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 raw manuscript form. A narrative. We know what we know by agreement with the others. A narrative, continuous, at best. We sleep and dream, we wake, we talk to one another, complacent in the keep of our years. And what we come to know, they bury with us, and the others carry on in their way. This is beginning with a line of one of my favorite poets. Beginning with a line of Anne Sexton. Today is made from yesterday and all those many intervals between. Something set in motion will continue in its course, as they say. In the beginning, it was already too late. Death's knowledge not yet known, yet certain. A constant possibility as such. And all the little children, unaware in their holy innocence, and the others, the elders, silent in their role as witness to time and death's insistence in the face of it. Gee, I did promise I'd lighten it up. I guess I'm wrong. You know, I always think it's wonderful for the people that can write funny poems. I don't know. I need a little more Brodigan and a little less Barrowman. Old Hills. This is for a friend of mine that some of you may have known, Henry Braun, Maine poet, wonderful man. He was right up to the end of it. He was, out there with the women in black every Wednesday in downtown Portland, and he was always going down to any protest. He protested right up to the end. I loved Henry for that. So this is called Old Hills for my friend Henry Braun. Like a wildflower, you have broken the soil in the deep Maine forest, in the shade of tall pines and old hills where no one ever goes but the spirits of the dead. Across the hours, I hear a bird call, a sorrowing song, like a prayer to the wind. Days of glory be. It's time to go back alone, the way you came. No, we're alone. Is that minutes or poems? Okay. Okay, well, before I exit, let me again thank the folks, primarily Henry, but if there's a board, I want to thank the board as well for having me here. It was really wonderful. Okay, I should read something. I forgot too much from the book. The book. So that Richard and Lindy are happy that I pushed the book. And thank all you folks for coming tonight. I appreciate it. This is a poem called Requiem for Robinson. And it's in the spirit of, in for, I guess you can say the late Wildland Keys, who knows. No witness, no witness, no witness to the crime, and the clues led nowhere. There will always be things left unsaid, things left undone. After all, the ending is your own. The tone has changed from F minor with an added six. The soundtrack of the age is just a drumbeat, slow and sad, with intermittent foghorn for effect. Already in the city's gray enclosure, there is an insistence in the day's demands, but there isn't any love. There isn't any love. And when you're gone, they will describe you in your own words and provide you with a proper denouement. Let it be enough. Let it be enough. Finished. No more. The end. Always difficult to know which one to leave you with. Hopefully one that you will... If I could only find one that was... light, but I can't. So. Anyway, we'll end with this is the perfect one to end with. For my late friend Robert, Maine Summers, Testament. So this song now, as how it could be, quiet it will be, full and securely wrought, a graceful sound, a careful construction, a song now sung with both eyes opened, a sign that something has moved, a song has been heard. Thank you very much.
So in this modern age, the way writers get their work out there is by selling them at poetry readings. And so I want to encourage people to Paul Callahan and Steve Luttrell have books for sale today. I encourage you to consider purchasing a copy. Steve, I was really pleased that you read a poem for Henry Braun, who's also an old friend. Henry, I met Henry in 1970 in Cambridge and found out that we grew up in Buffalo together, but he was about a decade older than me.
Isn't that right?
Yeah, we remained friends. Yeah, great poet. So about the time I met Henry Braun, I met Paul Callahan. I was a physics major at MIT, and Paul was a engineering major at Northeastern, and we found ourselves in a poetry workshop taught by Denise Levertov in 1970, and that was how we met. Paul then went off to Hampshire College, and some of the alumni of that poetry workshop formed the Mass Avenue Poetry Hawkers, where we would actually sit at the Central Square Dunkin' Donuts in Cambridge and get up and recite poems to all the homeless people sitting around. And Paul invited us out. I remember a memorable time you invited us all out to read at Hampshire. That was great. So this is sort of a story about how, you know, one starts out as a writer and meanders and then, you know, kind of eventually finds their voice, I think. Paul and I remained friends, and the next thing I knew, Paul was living in South Bristol, Maine, on the coast. He'd gone there to start a writer's colony, as I recall. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
Theater.
Yeah, they were all dramatists writing plays. But they found they couldn't really support themselves doing that, so they ended up becoming coastal fishermen. So Paul became a herring fisherman on the coast of Maine, and it was a very tough life. But Paul wrote me letters, and describing his comrades on the sea, the life of a fisherman in coastal Maine. And I told him, I'm going to keep all these letters because someday when you're not working so hard and you can eventually come back to them, you're going to write a book about this experience. So, I don't know, 30 or 40 years later, that's what we have here, is Paul's just wonderful description of the life of a coastal fisherman, which he lived. For a period of about ten years, wonderfully descriptive, detailed writing about the technology and all the. I remember learning from him about, you know, what purse seining, and I loved all that kind of wonderful technology about how the fishing industry worked. But it's also a really wonderful lyrical book and a deep appreciation of the community and the fishing life and the people who pursued that, sadly in a time when that's passing away, I think. So without further words, I would like to introduce Paul Callahan.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Henry, for having me. So this book covers a 10-year span of herring fishing in a period of 1972 to 82. So it was a long time ago. And I was 24 in 1972. And I landed in this tiny town of 500 people and discovered that the community of fishermen, which was at the time very isolated, no internet, no cell phone, of course, was really open. It's not what I expected. And they welcomed me into this very different culture than I had ever experienced. And so to me, it was like walking through a portal or a door into another world, and I was incredibly naive, and they loved it. You know, I asked them questions that no kid in the town would ever ask, who grew up in that town, and they wanted to know as much about me as I wanted to know about them. So I'm going to read a couple of chapters. The chapters are short. And the book starts with the prologue, which really dumps the reader into about 1975, midway in my fishing career. And overall, I'd say the book is about fear. And living on the water, working on the water is about fear. And ratcheting up your tolerance of fear. Sometimes working on the water was about increasing your tolerance for fear, raising the bar. And later, after the bar had been raised and the stories had been told, and they would be told because they served the purpose of making the new threshold ever more permanent, what you had feared in the past often seemed trivial or nonsensical. And in some cases, fear was about nothing at all, purely imaginary. But experiencing the fear could be paralyzing and nearly heart-stopping, just the same. This happened to me one beautifully calm night in July of 1975, 6 miles from Manhegan Island at about 3:30 a.m. I was on watch outbound on the Miss Angel, with everyone else turned in below, including the skipper, Arthur Mr. P. Poland. The fishing was very heavy, just southwest of the island. Big cod and pollock coming over the rail, alive and shining like newborns. But we had been going for 30 days without a break, and everyone was cranky and tired. It was one of those runs when you were making the bulk of your money for the whole year, but you wished the fish would stop being there and give you a break. It was my day to take the watch, the morning watch, 2 hours at the helm, making sure we didn't run anybody down. Staring at the eerie green sweep of the radar screen and looking around, taking a tour of the deck, watching the gauges, listening to the FM radio chatter and the recorded NOAA weather. The autopilot was making its shh-ting, shh-ting noises as it micro-adjusted the rudder, and the yellow Caterpillar turbocharger whistled a constant and penetrating high-pitched note. It was Sunday morning, and all of us had been drinking on the Saturday night, and some, including Mr. P, had kept pounding the booze and not gone to bed at all. Now he was in his bunk like the rest of the crew. Miss Angel made an easy 16 knots, which was very fast for a fishing boat. In truth, she was a wild plastic horse wrapped around a roaring diesel, much too lively in any sea action and as loud as a bass drum. It was dark, of course, and the moon had already set. Making sure you didn't run anything down was mostly looking out the forward windows to see if what you picked up on the radar matched what you saw out the window. Green blip on the radar should match up with red or green running lights or 360-degree white masthead light or both. We knew the schedule for the oil barge from Portland to Searsport, always worth watching for, since the tug had a very long cable out to the barge in tow, and you didn't want to run between the tug and the barge. If you did, the taut cable would rip your wheelhouse off in a half second and probably cleave you in two or more ugly pieces. But the probability of that happening was very low, since the tug sported a vast array of vertical white lights and was very hard to miss. Not running down other boats was always paramount, but equally important was making sure that there were no changes to the engine speed whatsoever. In other words, when a lowly deckhand draws the short straw for the watch in the wee hours, the last thing he ever wants to do is change the throttle the slightest, even 50 or 100 RPM, unless he has a real problem. If he does, everybody sleeping down below is immediately in the mad scramble, out bunk, on boots, and poking their hungover and groggy-looking faces up through the companionway to see what is going on. Why'd you slow down? What's going on, Cappy? Miss Angel was fast because she had a big engine. So we were all in the process of going deaf, listening to it whether we liked to or not. And when you turned in a boat like that, you actually didn't sleep. You rested and pretended to sleep. because you were lying in bunks next to a screaming six-cylinder Caterpillar diesel with a turbocharger that whined and whistled like a jet plane through a fiberglass bulkhead less than a quarter inch thick and no more than 10 or 15 feet away. Some guys wore aircraft headphones, but they were a pain to sleep in. Even if you were pretending, and the only alternative was plastic earplugs, which eventually made your ear holes hurt. That particular morning, there was a traditional sailboat race, the Portland to Monhegan race, that had started the previous day. We knew about the race, and we knew that the course of the race crossed our own course for the morning. So we were watching for sailboats so as not to run anybody down. After an hour on watch, I could see a line of sailboats on the radar that was clearly identifiable as the Monhegan race. All the boats were strung out in a line, but they were fairly close together. So I picked a sailboat target and adjusted the autopilot to point the Miss Angel directly at it. That was standard practice. Once you lined up the target, you could then pick out the sailboat by the lights through the forward window, right off the bow, and you could keep your eye on it. If the sailboat kept moving, which it should, and you stuck to your course line, you would go safely astern of the target boat. I picked the boat out, and I could see his red port side running light. Everything was fine. The sailboats, of course, could hear us coming, since it was so quiet under sail. And as was usually the case, he got a little excited as we got closer. The guy at the helm, the skipper or whatever, started waving a flashlight at me, hoping someone was at the wheel of this boat bearing down on them, like that was going to wake me up if I was asleep. And I'm sure the Miss Angel was making plenty of noise with a straight pipe of wet exhaust roaring out through her stern. So I turned on the big searchlight to let the guy know that I knew that he was there. And then I carefully shone the light astern of his sailboat because I didn't want to run down his dinghy if he had one in tow. Everything was cool, and I didn't have to slow down and get all the hungover guys jumping out of their bunks below and bumping into each other or banging into the galley stove and raising hell over nothing. We passed by the stern of the sailboat and didn't run down any dinghy in tow, because he wasn't towing any stupid dinghy, because he was in a race, I guess, and that would slow him down or something. So I went out and stood on the port side rail and felt the breeze on my face and listened to the Miss Angel growling and listened to the water hissing and shushing rhythmically off the hull, off the spray bars on her forward cheeks. Then I waved a flashlight back at the sailboat as he passed. The world was in order. But when I got back into the wheelhouse, I suddenly saw a bright light, a bright white light out the forward window, right off the port bow. Heartbeat escalation. Had to be a masthead light. Holy shit. How the fuck could I have missed that? I didn't understand, but I didn't have a lot of time to think. If a masthead was that close, I was right on top of a sailboat, 20 or 30 seconds away from a collision. I couldn't see any running lights, so it must be hove to or at anchor. But why would it be at anchor? Glanced at the depth recording. Jesus, we were in 70 or 80 fathoms of water. I suppose you could anchor up at that depth, but that doesn't make any sense. What the fuck is going on? What is he doing? Maybe he's running, but his running lights are out. Shit. I stepped over to the radar. I don't think I was breathing at this point. I was going to run this guy down. How could I have missed him? Mr. Smartass flashing the big spotlight and showing off, coming too close to the stern of that other boat. What a fucking idiot I am. A smartass idiot. The radar gain was turned up high, and there was greenish white clutter around the center of the screen. Maybe he's too close to see, I thought. So I turned down the range to 500 yards. I still couldn't see him. I must be right on top of him. I was going to run him down, for fuck's sake. That would wake everybody up all right. I had this heavy clutch in my stomach, and I reached for the throttle. One last look. Got to be sure. I ran back out on the deck to see if I could see him from the port side. I was about to turn this guy's boat into matchwood and chop him up into bloody pieces of arms and legs. I had to see him. By now, it was almost 4 o'clock, so there was a modicum of first light starting to show in the east and on the horizon. From the port side, with a clear view, I could see under the masthead light now. I could see the line of the horizon where the shadow of a boat should be. There was no boat sitting under the masthead light, just the horizon. It was the morning star, Venus. Maybe the masthead light of the galaxy. I had never seen it so bright. Thanks. So,
can you give us a minute to recover?
Did I what? Give us a minute to recover? Yeah. Yeah, I think it was one of the scariest moments of my entire 10 years, apart from, you know, the handful of times I thought I was going to die. So that was just pure imaginary fear. So, I'm going to read part of the first chapter, which is kind of frames the story. It's called Henry. And the structure of the book, and I'll say a little bit about swearing. There's a lot of swearing in this book. But on the water, swearing is kind of a, it's two things. It's really about release. You know, it's about, everybody swears. And it's just, it's kind of a sense of, it's a humor, too. It's, so there's all a mixture of those two things. And I remember one of the guys I fished with read a chapter in this book in which there was a tremendous amount of swearing. And his mother, who had lived in South Bristol all her life and been around fishermen all her life, got very agitated with him and said, totally misinterpreted, you know, the swearing thing, because she'd never been on a boat, right? Been on the water, you know. She said, "Well, Jesus, Chucky, well, I don't think Arthur was being very nice to all those boys on the boat. I think he's quite abusive. He's swearing at him like that." And Chucky said, "Oh, for Christ's sake, Ma, that's what everybody talks like in the water. There's nothing to it, you know, just a sense of humor." "Oh, I'm sorry, Chuck, you know, that's..." And the accents, too, are also very exaggerated on the water. And it's very different than inland accents, and radio talk is even a more extreme accent. People really put it on when they talk on the radio to each other, and it's just very funny stuff. So this is chapter one, Henry. 40 years ago, I fell in love with a place of great beauty and a way of life that is now gone. My infatuation lasted 10 years, and in the end, I was defeated by the impossibility of that love. But nothing could have kept me from it. Nothing. It was where I had to go, a door I had to open. The story is worth listening to, I promise you. It starts in 1972 in South Bristol, Maine, a town of 500 souls. "Them Zinks was all disimmigrated," Henry says. "Every bit of 'em was gone." Henry is the king of malaprops, but he doesn't care what anybody thinks. Something close to the right word is good enough for him. Besides, nobody dares correct him. In the forecastle of the LSM, six of us crammed in there for coffee at 5 a.m., the light dim and the air thick with cigarette smoke, listening to 64-year-old Henry Jones. Nobody dares because this is his boat. And most everybody, except me, is on his herring crew, and they have been with him for most of their fishing lives. I am visiting my friend Gladden Schrock, a playwright and fisherman on Henry's crew, who has lived in South Bristol for 15 years. Fresh from college, I have no plans. Freshman college, I have no plan. I don't know it yet, but I have stepped into a reality that will change my life forever. Walked through some secret doorway to a place where a career path and credentials and a map of the future are irrelevant, where the physical world is everything, all anyone thinks about and talks about. The corrosive creative force of the sea, catching something alive and selling it for food and money, living to the next day and the next day. This place will soon invade and permanently alter my educated head, and Henry Jones will become an irreplaceable touchstone for the 10 years I plunge headlong into fishing. But hell, I don't know any of this. I am clueless and beautifully stupid of this place. I can make out the shapes of stuff taking place in front of me, though, like I can see that the guys sitting in this galley really don't care that I don't know anything. Ha, that's pretty clear. And I'm thinking that maybe they prefer it that way. Get this. They find it amusing. Hell, they find it hilarious at times that I am such a dope about their world. That's kind of a cool thing, and it even seems to have some kind of redeeming value. Maybe because I'm so foreign, it doesn't matter. Either way, they appear to extend the level of forgiveness to my stupid questions that would never be extended to the kids who grew up in South Bristol, because those kids should know better. And something else. It feels to me like they say, and mostly do, whatever they want. They take whatever they need, work only when they need to work, do what needs to be done. Not on anybody else's time schedule, operating on a clock that is based on pure necessity to catch and kill wild fish. Back to Henry. He is interrupted as a yellow beam of daylight cuts down through the smoke like a spotlight from above. The short and roly-poly Mr. P has opened the companionway hatch to the morning sunrise and jumps down the ladder with a thud. "Jesus Christ, boys, I thought the galley was all afire down here. There's so much smoke," he booms as he waves his hand at the smoke. Henry stops. "That's the smoke coming out of your ass, Mr. P. At least that's what Mrs. P tells me. Ha ha. Now get your coffee, would ye? And stop making such a crazy commotion." "Don't mind me, Henry. Just keep on talking. I'm sure I've heard it before." "No, you ain't heard it before. You know that better. You know better than that." Henry waits while Mr. P pours a coffee and then restarts his story about the iron fastenings that had melted away on a boat that wasn't properly grounded. "Roy has heard this one." Henry nods to Roy Vose, his old friend and spotter pilot. Henry never tells the same story twice without first acknowledging those who had heard the story previously. "You remember this one too, Glad," now looking at Gladden sitting across from me. "So then, they said she was all wired up so fucking wrong, so completely ass backwards, that the boat was hot as hell. They couldn't keep no amount of zincs on her. All of them was eaten up almost immediately. Eaten up in a week's time or thereabouts. So what do they do? Well, the owner just gives up on her completely and stops replacing zincs altogether. And them iron fastenings
just disintegrated in no time at all. No time at all. It was so bad that when they brought her in, the boys at the shipyard said you could lean over the side and see the Christly bubbles from the electrolysis coming off her right there in the water. They said it was like the bubbles you see inside of a glass of ginger ale. Henry goes on about how the rampant electrolysis had dissolved all the iron screws, and then how a few of the boat's planks had even fallen off when they hauled her out on the big shipyard railway. Once the outside water pressure on the hull against the hull wasn't holding them against the frames anymore. I can keep going with this chapter. I'll call it good, I think. Sitting there, I am flashing back to how I got there. How I met Gladden in my last year at Hampshire College, far away from here, like another planet, really. How I'm sitting on the floor in the theater, sporting a giant bird's nest of a red beard that I hadn't cut in 4 years, an old limpy t-shirt and jeans, and I'm walking two actors through a one-act play I've written about a homeless man living on a park bench. The man is assaulted by an amorphous force, a character costumed in a giant gray sack, a force that periodically pummels him as he tries to ask questions and reason through his life. Gladden's arrival in the experimental amphitheater stops the rehearsal as he reaches down with his maw of a hand, more like a baseball mitt, and introduces himself as both a one-time visiting playwright and a herring fisherman. We become friends throughout the term. Then in the spring, when he is leaving for home, he invites me for a visit, says he is thinking of starting a theater in Maine. For my part, all I can think about is how little I know. How little I know about surviving on my own, how the Vietnam War has us all circling the drain, how I need to feel the heat and the sweat of the world and learn something, anything, about how to survive there. Then I'm thinking all matter of romantic tripe, like why not touch the sea, the primordial source of all life, and the unpredictable master of danger. Yeah, that should fix us up, all right. And the fact that Gladden lives there and works in the water is perfect. In June, my girlfriend, Joy Vaughn, and I drive to South Bristol. We rent a yellow house just across the drawbridge on Rutherford's Island, looking out at the shipyard in the Western Gut, the center of town at the tip of the Bear Peninsula. I start working as a carpenter in the day and searching for herring at night with Henry and Gladden, and riding out with the mackerel trappers on weekends to see what it's like. Joy begins waitressing in Damariscotta. But some form of reality jolt has already happened. Some knot's been broken open, untwisted, just by making the decision to move. Like I said, I don't really know what is going on. I'm 24, for Christ's sake. Nobody knows what they're doing at that age. Joy has 3 years on me in age, at 27, but we're both of us just out of our minds. One day, still in the early summer of the first year, I burst into the kitchen in the yellow house back from a morning ride with Junior Farron and his trapping crew, and I'm telling Joy how I ended up standing in a dory up to my thighs in these beautiful mackerel, how we had rolled a huge hoop net full of them over the rail, how they thundered aboard in a shower of water and tiny scales, slapping their last gasp all around us. Hands on her hips, cigarette in hand, curling smoke, looking at me with wondrous amusement, she interrupts me and says, "You are absolutely in love, aren't you?" No one to mince words, Joy. "You're in love with the ocean and the sea." I'm kind of stunned, speechless for a moment. Then I say, "No, it's the fish. I'm in love with the fish." Truth is, I love them both. I love Joy, too. She is the love of my life. but now I have this competing romance that's making my heart race. I have to admit it. Growing up in the suburbs of Boston, I have never witnessed creatures with such wildness and innocence combined. And over time, I will discover that pulling fish out of the water and over the rail never gets old. Never. Being poor does get old, though. I can say that with great certainty. Because we are dirt poor, for all of the 10 years I chase fish, winter and summer, up and down the Gulf of Maine. But touching the lives of creatures that live in the ocean, that feeling of surprise and the look in their eyes never does. Thank you.